Things can change rapidly. Things can change overnight. We've seen over our history, people that were thought to be the leader, the undisputed leader, and go back in either party, this is the person that's going to win. And then something happens and things collapse and others emerge. And so the only way you find out is actually play the game.
That's North Dakota Governor and GOP presidential candidate Doug Burgum, making the case that frontrunner Donald Trump does not have a lock on his party's nomination. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. Doug Burgum is a fourth-generation North Dakotan and a descendant of pioneers and farmers.
I grew up in a tiny town in North Dakota. Woke was what you did at 5 a.m. to start the day.
Burgum found success in the private sector as a CEO and investor before turning to politics with a run for governor in 2016. At the first GOP primary debate, Burgum presented an optimistic vision for America.
As president, I will bring out the best of America. I will improve every American life.
In contrast, Governor Burgum says President Biden is leading the country in the wrong direction on every major issue, including national security, the economy, and energy policy.
I see it a front row seat as the governor with the Biden administration, where they're always stepping out of their lane and they're always trying to bigfoot, particularly, you know, states that are actually resource producing states, the people that are feeding and fueling the world.
Governor Burgum spoke to me this week from Iowa, where he was adamant that it's time for the GOP to look forwards, not backwards.
As a Republican Party, if we're talking about 2020, that's the way we lose. Biden's candidacy totally depends on us talking about the past and infighting.
But can Burgum win the GOP nomination without directly taking on the former president?
You said at the last debate, Governor, that Mike Pence did the right thing on January 6th. Did Donald Trump do the wrong thing? Governor Doug Burgum, welcome to Firing Line.
Margaret, great to be with you. Excited to be with you. Honored to be with you.
You, Governor, have an extensive record of success in the private sector. And you have been elected to a second term as the governor of North Dakota. Your family has deep roots in North Dakota, dating back to the 1800s. Your great-grandmother was the first woman to hold elective office in the Dakota Territory. Your grandmother was one of the first children born in what would become Bismarck. And your grandparents started a grain business over 100 years ago that's still in the family today. How has this legacy influenced you?
Well, one of the things that I find amazing about my great-grandmother and her coming to North Dakota after the Civil War with her husband, who was a doctor on the fighting for the North, they ended up at an outpost, first Fort Rice, then actually Fort Abraham Lincoln. They were their contemporaries with George Armstrong Custer before he went off to his fatal fight. But she kept a diary. Some of the earliest history of North Dakota was her writing down and understanding that it was moving from fortress to farm, that the transition was going away. Then the actual State Historic Society in North Dakota, its foundational elements came from the fact that pre-statehood, for over 20 years, she and other women in Bismarck had been understanding the rapid change that was occurring, and they wanted to save that piece of transition in history. And she was a correspondent like you. She wrote articles for Eastern newspapers. She was a contemporary of Susan B. Anthony. She was trying to get the state of North Dakota, would have been amazing, admitted to the Union in 1889 with women having the right to the vote at the time it entered the Union. She was not successful in that event, but the letters still exist at the State Historical Society of her efforts to do that. So she was a change agent. She was elected to office when she couldn't even vote for herself. And she was the first superintendent of public schools. So it was, it's an inspiration for me when I read her diaries, understand, and had that direct link to my grandmother, who was born. She lived long enough into her 90s that I actually grew up going to her house after elementary school. And she taught me how to, you know, play chess and other things. I mean, seeing someone like my grandmother, who literally in 1889 at statehood was riding a horse in the 4th of July parade in Bismarck ahead of statehood, and leading the parade was Sitting Bull. She was in that parade representing the state of Kentucky, where her family had come from before they moved to Dakota Territory. So it's an incredible history, but it also, I think, is inspiring to not just myself. We can't choose our relatives, but I think a lot of people have been inspired by the pioneer women in North Dakota. She certainly is one of them that helped shape our state from the very beginning.
How has it inspired you?
Well, I think it's the whole family. And then you carry it down to my mom and my dad. My dad was, you know, grew up in the same town, Arthur, 300 people that I did. He had a college degree. Pearl Harbor happened. He went down the road to Castleton, North Dakota, into the gym and signed up for the Navy. I don't think he knew how to swim because there's no water in our town or anywhere near it. I know for sure he'd never seen the ocean, but put him through the Great Lakes Naval Training Station. 90 days later, they called him 90 Day Wonders. They're churning out naval officers. And then he proposed to my mom, of course, after he enlisted. Then they got married. Then he got put on a destroyer, didn't see her for over 2 years during the war. And he lived to tell it, only by the grace of God. There was 151 destroyers at Okinawa. 129 of them were hit by kamikazes, but my dad was on one that wasn't. And he made it all the way to Tokyo Bay, September 2nd, 1945. Mm-hmm. It was his 28th birthday. And then they came home back to Arthur and started raising a family. But I learned from him about service and sacrifice. And I learned from my mother about perseverance and a don't quit attitude and the, you know, the willingness to give back to community. So I've been blessed with generations of role models.
We just had the first Republican debate. You were able to eke out about 8 minutes of speaking time as you introduced yourself to the American people. Were you satisfied that you were able to distinguish yourself amongst the other candidates on the stage?
Well, I'm not satisfied. I would like to have the whole 2 hours to myself to introduce myself. So because we would have plenty to talk about, particularly if we were going to talk about the things that matter to this country, like our economy, highest interest rates in 22 years, inflation out of control, being our debt downgraded, our national debt at record levels. Now we've got global transactions in petro happening in non-dollar denominated. I mean, our status as a reserve currency is risk. So everything that we've built, the current model of let's just keep raising the debt limit, let's keep spending more, let's keep, you know, shoving money into the economy, that's all at risk. And then we're in an actual kinetic war, a proxy war with Russia. We're in a cold war with China. We're in a cyber war every day with both of them. And we seem to have an attention issue to not focus on the things that matter the most. And one thing I know as a CEO and one thing I know as a governor is if you don't have the top leader focused on the things that mattered the most, a lot of things can go off the rails in a hurry. And so I would love to have spent more time in that debate talking about substantive issues that are really facing this country.
Governor, I appreciate so much your interest in focusing on the issues and on the policies, and I want to get to a lot of them. But first, I just want to ask you about the politics and your path to the nomination. Is it through Iowa?
Well, we're focusing equally on Iowa and New Hampshire. In both of these states, we found a real affinity from the people that are on the ground and the issues that face them. Because whether you're a farmer in Iowa putting diesel into your tractor or whether you're a lobsterman in New Hampshire that's putting diesel in your boat, and both cases, you might be a fourth generation farmer or lobsterman, and both of them are facing inflationary prices, energy policies, and other policies that are causing them stress. And when, you know, the average American family in these two, you know, just like in every other state, in these two states are facing $700 more a month than they were when Joe Biden was elected in cost, $8,400 a year. They're really feeling it right in their pocketbook. And so, we love the fact that and these are two states when we get around. I mean, I grew up in agriculture. The first lady's family was in the John Deere business. We feel right at home in Iowa. And then in New Hampshire, when we were building a global software business with kids from small towns in North Dakota, we had team members. We had acquired a company in Manchester, New Hampshire. We had a product relationship with another one in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire. And, I love America. I've been to all 50 states, but these are two, we just started in any two states, but we love we're starting in these two.
Well, the second debate is coming up. It's scheduled for later this month. If you hit the polling threshold to participate, what'd you learn from the first debate in order to do anything differently second go around?
Well, we've received a lot of positive feedback from people about actually exhibiting characteristics that people think are, in leadership, which is when you're trying to pick a superintendent for your school, when you're trying to pick a new pastor for the parish, when you're trying to pick a CEO, you know, for a boardroom, the selection process doesn't include who's got the snappiest retort and who can call each other names and who can make up stuff on the fly. That's not the criteria. I think Americans actually understand what leadership looks like. Character, integrity, honesty, actually, you know, sharing facts, staying focused on the issues. So there's some things we won't change at all, but certainly next go round, we're going to be more assertive in interjecting ourselves into conversations than we were last time, because this whole idea of, oh, I've been invoked, and then it ping pongs back and forth, and then you're another 30-minute segment's gone by. You know, it's not really helpful. I mean, because I'm sure it's great entertainment for the public, because controversy sells. Divisiveness is a gigantic profitable business in our country, both in cable news and also on clickbait, because the clickbait, you know, the divisiveness stimulates people to click on ads and for eyeballs. So we're fighting against American-made capitalist business models. And at some point, we probably have to say, is this the right way for us to select leaders to actually lead us through these difficult times?
Is it the right way?
Well, I hope that one thing that doesn't happen is with these arbitrary criteria being created by the RNC in conjunction with the networks, that you're actually doing the job that the voters are supposed to do. I mean, we had a tradition that early states, early caucus states, and early primary states, they're able to thin out the crowd. And if you take Iowa and New Hampshire, the 98% of the electoral college votes are still available when those two are done, but those two have always thinned out the field. And that the idea that somehow we've got to have national criteria is just exclusionary to people that have, you know, fresh ideas but don't have national name recognition. I mean, there's examples in the past of people that were in zero and single digits in Iowa the summer before that went on mm-hmm. to win the Iowa caucus. But if you're going to exclude voices like that, I think competition is good for the Republican Party. It's good for America. And I hope we're not moving to a place where, you know, clubhouse rules and one network is going to decide, you know, who the candidates are that people actually get to vote for in January.
So what should be different?
Well, I think when you've got a field this small is, you know, let people debate or else, again, if you have a set of rules around a debate, you know, have the questions and the debate rules actually talk about the policy as opposed to, again, being, you know, cable infotainment where, you know, sort of anything goes. Because I know a lot of people that, you know, political junkies watch that. I know what got all everything got retweeted was the conflict, but I also know that we've talked to people that are supporting us that said, hey, when all that started happening and the name calling, I just turned off the TV because I am so sick that this is what America, this is how we're deciding a president. This is the leadership selection model. So there's a group out there that's calling the exhausted majority in the middle that is not enthralled by this process. And all you have to do is look at the ratings. You can say, hey, look at the ratings, we're so high. But that's only a tiny fraction of the people in this country. Most people in this country aren't paying attention, don't want to pay attention, because that's not helpful to them.
Are the exhausted majority part of the GOP primary electorate?
Well, some of them are and some of them aren't. I think one of the things that we have in all the elections in America is, how do we get more engagement? I think one of the things that we're doing is trying to make sure that when we're talking to people, that we're talking to everybody, and they know that, as we did in North Dakota, when elected, whether people voted for us or not, we serve them once we were in that office. And, you know, the simplest example, I say, when there's a blizzard, you know, we plow the roads for independents, Democrats, and Republicans in North Dakota when there's a blizzard. It's not like, oh, we're only going to do things for the people that voted for us. We've got to get back to the understanding that the executive branch is actually leading operations. They have to have vision, leadership, execution on both policy and the delivery of government services. And the job is to serve everyone. It's not to, you know, weaponize things and attack the other party. It's actually in service to this country.
I want to move on to the policies, but it just occurs to me, Governor, you said something about the exhausted majority, and I think that really does resonate. It feels like the primary process is less focused on the policies and the ideas than traditionally the conservative movement and the Republican Party has been. And it seems to me that change and departure has really happened in the last 8 years. And yet, Trump continues to lead the field. How do you understand that?
Well, I'll leave the punditry to the pundits, because this is, you know, 7x24 cable, lots of people, panels every, you know, Sunday morning, people, you know, trying to, you know, unpack all this. But I do know from my own state, which is a lot of the people that supported President Trump supported us during our elections in 16 and 20. And I think that part of their voice was, hey, we were forgotten. People don't, someone needs to, you know, remember that we're here. And this is the hardworking men and women of, you know, America. And whether those are, you know, whether they're farmers, whether they're ranchers, whether they're oil field workers, whether it's nurses, these folks are, you know, all paying attention in some ways to, you know, who cares about us? And I think that's been part of right now. The thought is that movement was about really understanding and recognizing that there was a people that were being left behind, and whether it was being left behind by the two coasts, or you split the numbers, you see them on the big chart, you know what's blue and you know what's red. And we know that, you know, most of the, you know, rural counties in America end up red, no matter, you know, how the election turns out. And that's a population we're very familiar with. So I understand how they feel, and I want them to know that I see them, I hear them, I feel them. But I also know that we've got policies and approaches that can deliver better results for them.
You are the only candidate who is running for president from an overwhelmingly rural state. You grew up in a small town. You're also a successful tech entrepreneur. There is a huge and growing division between urban and rural counties in this country, both culturally and economically. The rise of AI, artificial intelligence, is going to compound this even further. How do you help rural America rebound?
Well, I think we've got a good blueprint of what's going on in North Dakota. I mean, we're on track to have the highest GDP of any state in the nation. We've got the highest GDP of any Republican-led state in the nation. And we're doing that with a focus on innovation versus regulation. So much of what comes out of Washington, D.C. today, you got a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. that writes 800 pages in something like the Waters of the USA, and then they try to dump it on a state like North Dakota, and it affects 90% of our land. So it affects, you know, all of the farm and ranch families in the state, and they may have never set foot in our state. And I'll tell you, nobody cares more about the soil health, the air quality, the water quality. Nobody cares about the future of that than the families that are living there and raising their families and raising their crops, building their lives on that for their kids and their grandkids. Nobody cares more. And so in some of this, I go back to the 10th Amendment, which is the federal government has a specific set of responsibilities that were delegated to them. By who? Delegated by the states to the federal government. The states created the federal government. And I've seen it as an entrepreneur. I've seen it running global businesses. And now I see it a front row seat as the governor with the Biden administration, where they're always stepping out of their lane and they're always trying to bigfoot particularly states that are actually resource producing states, the people that are feeding and fueling the world, the ones that are actually the policies that would actually stabilize the world coming from states like ours, you know, are under attack because of an ideology that's about regulation versus an ideology, or not an ideology, but an understanding that America's advantage has always been innovation. The way we beat China in a Cold War is through innovation. And so I don't know that it's as much, I don't see this thing sometimes as rural versus urban. When we've built companies, we've had people working for me in all the largest cities of the world. When you have people working in 120 countries for you, they're usually in the cities that are larger than we have in the United States. There's a lot of economic activity and ideas and stuff that comes from large cities. But we've also, in the United States, I mean, you know, our large cities right now are not a showcase. If you landed here from a first-time visitor to the United States and went to some of our cities today, and that was your impression of America, you wouldn't be coming away and saying, that's the best of America. Who would say that's the best of America? They would be like shuddering and going home and saying, I'm never going to vacation in the United States again. So we've got some big issues that we have to fix. But I think in this case, you know, there's always this idea that somehow the big cities and the big population areas have all the answers for the rural areas, then in some cases, you know, this might be flipped. I mean, that we, you know, some small town approaches might be the things, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community, might be the way that you actually solve some of the challenges that we're facing in our large metros.
You have focused quite a bit on your campaign on energy policy. And you've said that President Biden's energy policies are, quote, wrong on every front. And you have consistently called on him to increase domestic oil production. Let me get your response to some of the following facts about domestic oil production being on track to hit a record high this year. Biden administration has approved more drilling permits in its first 2 years than the Trump administration did in the same period. And there are over 6,000 oil permits that are not being used currently. So what part of Biden's energy policies are wrong? And what would you do differently?
Well, first of all, I would love to have online or offline a discussion about the facts you're sharing, because we just won a lawsuit in North Dakota. The Biden administration is the first administration since the Truman administration that hasn't held the lawfully required quarterly lease sales for oil and gas on federal lands. Didn't hold a single lease sale in the first 2 years. And so then we win in court, 82-page ruling that says, no, actually the federal government is required to follow the law like the rest of us. And then they had, all of these lease sales, and then they went into it and said, nope, this one's thrown out because it's got a misspelled word. This one's thrown out. They threw out about 80% of the applications. They threw out some because they said the application for the lease sale, when you bid to have the land be put up for auction, was too dated. Well, the reason it was dated was because they weren't holding the action. So this is, it's like, I don't want to say juvenile, but it is absolutely insolent on their part to now actively try to go around a court order. And so the stat that they're throwing out that they've got you reading is on these things that they've approved, those were applications that happened under the Trump administration, and they belatedly got them out the door, but they literally haven't held a lease, in the first 2 years. And so I feel that's a complete misrepresentation. They are actively trying to shut down. Biden said it himself, no more drilling. I mean, he said the quiet part out loud, read it in the court document. The president of the United States said no more drilling when they're required by law to actually hold those lease sales. So, and we know that during COVID, when the price was going up at the pump, guess who drained the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in half, $800 million down to $400 million? The Biden administration. They made a decision that was not strategic. That's for the United States of America, for the security of our country during a time of great conflict, to use that Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And apparently now it's strategic to try to get the price down at the pump before midterms. And then, of course, you all know, everybody reported on it, that he went to the Middle East and was fist bumping people and saying, hey, could you increase your production? And the State Department went to Venezuela, a country that has 7.5 million people have fled Venezuela. Many have tried to cross over illegally into our country. I get why they're fleeing, because you've got a country that's in collapse. That's dirty Venezuelan oil. They don't even have an EPA. And the State Department was asking if they could increase production for the sole purpose of trying to get priced down before the midterms. They weren't calling Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Oklahoma, Texas, or Alaska, the big oil producing states, and saying, could we produce increased production here? No, they were going to our adversaries and asking them to produce, that energy. So I reject the premise of the question.
Okay, so then what would you do differently, Governor?
Well, I think the simple thing is we have to start, selling energy to our friends and allies and stop in this thing where we're not selling it to our friends and allies. We should be the ones selling it. I mean, the question that got asked in the debate multiple ways and multiple times is, should we give more money to Ukraine or less money to Ukraine? Bigger than a bread box, smaller than a bread box. That's not the strategic question. The strategic question is, why did Russia feel entitled, empowered, unthreatened? Why did they feel like they could just march into Ukraine when they did? Well, they did because our deterrents weren't working, our green lighting of our withdrawal of Afghanistan, et cetera. And then belatedly, we decided to put oil price caps and sanctions on Russian oil, not on day one, not because we talked about it ahead of time and said, if you cross this line, we will do this. No, we wait a while. Price went up because of the disruption. Putin himself makes a bunch of money because he gets a cut off of all of Russian oil production. And then now, they're selling below the world price, and who's buying it? China's one of the biggest buyers of Russian oil, so we turn Russia into the discount gas station for China. And I'm sure, again, those farmers in Iowa, lobstermen, they would love to be getting diesel at 20% off tomorrow. They're not. China is. And so when I say that these policies are wrong, they're actually empowering dictators, destabilizing the world, and hurting the American economy, and creating inflation here at home. And that's all factual.
U.S. oil and natural gas exports are still at record highs, though, Governor. Exports to Europe have been increasing since early 2021 and now are higher than under the Trump administration. So why is that?
Well, that's because, in part, because Europe has finally figured out that they shouldn't be 100% dependent on Russian energy. But we're still even in the lower 48 right now. At the time of the Russian invasion, we were offloading 400,000 barrels of oil a day equivalent into New England of dirty Russian heating oil. Why is that? Because the number one drop in CO2 emissions in this country in the last 20 years has been the conversion of adding in clean U.S. natural gas in replace of coal. And so when we do that, that's always a good thing. If you care about the environment, you would say you'd want to have all energy produced in the United States, all baseload electrons, everything produced here, because we do it cleaner, safer, smarter, and better than anyone else. But when we're doing that, I'm in New Hampshire, and then there's New Hampshire. 41% of the people in New Hampshire are still heating their homes with heating oil, because you cannot get clean natural gas from Pennsylvania into New England because you can't get a pipeline permitted, because people say, fossil fuel's bad. You know, I say pipeline, you say protest. How about we say, if you really care about CO2 emissions, let's use natural gas as a transition fuel and get it done right now, because that's the thing that's actually really dropping CO2 emissions. So again, if this is innovation as opposed to regulation, the regulation that says that, and then flip to the other side of the world, where we were at a trade mission in Japan in October. This is a country with 126 million people that's in the size of Iowa plus North Dakota, and they have zero oil and gas production. They're getting all of they're entirely dependent on our adversaries. This is the country that so many sailors and Marines and soldiers fought and died for when we liberated Japan, and I'll add Korea, add Philippines, add all those. And we have almost no production that's going from the United States to Japan. We should have shipping lanes, you know, coming from the West Coast of the United States, but you can't get a pipeline with clean natural gas from the Permian Basin or from the Bakken, you know, through Oregon, Washington, or California, because people think that's, you know, bad for the environment, that we'd be shipping these to our allies. So what is Japan doing? Japan is stockpiling Australian coal on the ground. So when World War III breaks out, they'll still have baseload electricity. That's not good for the environment.
Well, speaking of the environment, you've been critical of Biden's climate initiatives, pointing out, for example, that selling more electric vehicles with batteries made in China is environmentally counterproductive. Some of the opponents who are on the stage with you on that GOP debate don't even acknowledge that climate change is a problem, but you have committed to making North Dakota carbon neutral by the end of the decade. Share with me how you're doing that.
Well, we're doing it all through innovation, not regulation. And we have multiple ways we can do this, but you know, one of the biggest ways we can do it is through carbon sequestration and carbon utilization for enhanced oil recovery. And we got a company in North Dakota that takes CO2 off of a gas plant. So you're decarbonizing a gas, natural gas plant, you put it in a pipe, you compress it, you ship it 105 miles, you put it down an oil well, the CO2 stays in the ground, and when the oil comes up, it actually produces less CO2 when refined and consumed than what was put in the ground. So we got an oil company in North Dakota that's greener than Patagonia, and we're, you know, going down a path of spending $1 trillion subsidizing 500,000 EV charging stations and then subsidizing the cars themselves, which of course is a separate topic, because that doesn't work. When we subsidize higher education, when we subsidize healthcare, the price goes up, not down. When you subsidize EV cars, the price will go up. It won't save anybody anything. And then 85% of the rare earth minerals are controlled by China. And read the New York Times from last week. Look at the pictures. They're destroying Indonesia, the Congo, with all of these places where they're just indiscriminately doing mass amounts of mining. They call them rare earth minerals because they're measured in parts per million. You have to move hundreds of thousands of pounds of earth in a mining operation to get the material to make one battery that then we're subsidizing with taxpayer dollars. And if the whole goal of that was to eliminate CO2 emissions, and you said, we've got a way to do it right now without having to, you know, shut down every gas station, you know, shut down every, you know, anybody that's got a liquid fueled vehicle, you might say, let's at least have that conversation. But there's so much cancel culture around climate, we can't even have a discussion about climate policy. I'd like to have we're having a discussion in North Dakota about climate policy. How can we get to zero through innovation? That's the way we win as a country. We don't say no. bad. I mean, like these, pejorative things, and then say good, bad, when we're not looking at the system economics, because there's the whole, you have to drive an EV like 70,000 miles to get to break even on carbon based on all the carbon intensity that went into the vehicle creation in the first place. I always would like to have a rational discussion with rational people and say, what would be the policy that would stabilize the world, help drive inflation down, improve the American economy, help us win the Cold War. Don't trade OPEC for Sino-OPEC. That's not a solution. That's actually worse, because China has got a 100-year plan, and it doesn't include good things for the United States. I mean, we're in their crosshairs. We're in a Cold War with them every day. We're in a cyber war with them every day. And the idea that somehow we're going to have all of our transportation be dependent on China going forward is ludicrous.
I want to ask you about immigration and also about the economy. You visited the southern border last month, where North Dakota National Guard troops have been stationed to help with security. And I know you recognize that there's a crisis at the border. There's also significant labor shortages in our economy that could be helped by some form of immigration reform. How do you think about immigration reform broadly?
Well, first of all, thank you for acknowledging that we've got a crisis. I mean, I think this is, the most underreported story every single day. Because if you take the official numbers from the Biden administration in 2.5 years, the population of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, throw in Joe Biden's home state of Delaware, and then toss in Montana, population, those six states, every man, woman, and child, that gets you to about 6 million, 6.5 million people. That's how many people we have a record of that have entered the United States illegally. That's the asylum seeker number we have. There's another number, which is the gotaways, which we see on camera, but we don't know where they went or where they went to. So the number is larger than that. But, and if people want to enter our country, we've got ports of entry. We have 18 of them in North Dakota. We have a 365-mile border. I love when people enter our country legally. And so we should make it easy for people to enter legally, hard to make it illegally. That's pretty simple. And then, of course, I grew up in a state. We talked about my grandmother. In 1900 in Fargo, 80% of the people living in that town of Fargo in 1900, English was their second language. I mean, we had, Germans, Norwegians, Swedes, Danish, everybody immigrating to North Dakota. We're very fresh. We understand immigration in North Dakota. We wouldn't have a state without immigration. We wouldn't be the breadbasket of the world. We wouldn't be an energy powerhouse, producing more energy than most OPEC countries if we didn't have that. And so we have to have it. But unfortunately, in our party, the Republican Party, I don't think we can have a discussion about illegal immigration policy until we secure the border. Once we stop the flow of, hundreds of thousands of people a month, and once we stop, and there's four Vietnam's worth of overdose deaths that have occurred since Biden took office. It's 250,000 and climbing in terms of overdose deaths, and 70% of those are fentanyl poisonings. And that's, again, I feel like we're taking mass casualties from China. So there's a reason to close and secure the border. That's part of national security, one of the jobs of the president to do that. And the federal government, that's their job to do it. And then we need to have a discussion, because right now, I think you probably saw the story 2 weeks ago, Canada has peeled off like 1 million high-skilled people from the United States. When we have students like that I know in North Dakota who get a master's degree in computer science, and two women there who complete their studies, and then their student visas run out and they can't get a work visa, so they get sent back to India, and they would love to stay and work here. Then Canada is advertising to them and saying, well, don't go back to India. Come to Canada. Come to Canada, pay a fee. But we've got high-skilled immigration. Canada has picked off 1 million high-skilled people. And that wouldn't, as you noted, we have 10 million jobs available in America, and we're going to have chronic labor shortages for a period of time because of the baby boomers that are retiring versus the young people that are entering the workforce. And when you've got chronic labor shortages, that also drives up inflation, which raises the cost for everybody. So we've got to balance labor. And one way to do that would be with smart immigration policy.
Governor, earlier this year, you vetoed a school choice bill that would have offset some costs for families sending children to private schools, saying that it fell short of, quote, meaningfully enhancing school choice. As president, would you make expanding school choice a federal priority, or do you see that as another issue that is best left to the states?
I think that's absolutely a question best left to the states. And I believe that we need competition. Competition makes us better. We definitely need competition in how we deliver services. But I, you know, the bill in North Dakota at the end of the day, you know, we spend $1 billion a year on K-12 education. We heavily invest in K-12 and higher education in North Dakota. We believe in education. This bill at the end of the day, I think was $10 million. It was 1% of the budget. And all it was going to do was going to provide a little bit of a, you know, tuition relief for the existing families that already were, you know, paying for their kids to go to parochial schools. And I think we would have missed the opportunity for really meaningful reform, because it has to be done in a way that actually, you know, enhances the opportunity for all students, not just for a fraction of them, and not just for, you know, the families that can perhaps already afford it. It's got to work for everybody. It's got to work in our cities. It's got to work in our rural schools. And there are some examples of where there's progress. Arizona and Iowa have done some nice things, but this has got to be done at the state level.
You have called for ridding the country of the Department of Education. Ronald Reagan argued for the exact same thing on the original firing line with William F. Buckley Jr. back in 1980, soon after the department had been established as a cabinet-level agency.
I would like to dissolve the $10 billion National Department of Education created by President Carter and turn schools back to the local school districts where we built the greatest public school system the world has ever seen. I think I can make a case that the decline in the quality of public education began when federal aid became federal interference.
Governor, the Department of Education as we know it now has a budget of around $80 billion, not 10. Do you propose ridding us of the department entirely? And how would you go about doing it?
Well, I think the broader discussion and talking about how we've been able to, in North Dakota, reduce the general fund, our first year in office, by 27% and still kept all the trains running on time. But that's because government doesn't have the pressures that the private sector does. When any business that's in the private sector that's got real competition has got to figure out a way to deliver better service tomorrow at a lower cost. So they got to drive towards efficiency. And the federal government just adds layers and layers and layers, and nothing pulls out cost. And sometimes it doesn't pull out the actual activity that someone thought was a good idea in the form of a piece of red tape or regulation. So we end up with, you know, in a typical government job, 10 to 20% of every job with great people that are committed, that perhaps went into public service because they want to make a difference in people's lives. But even they know that 10 to 20% of their job is some mind-numbing, soul-sucking work that doesn't add any value to any citizen. And so one of the things that we have to do is not just sort of run around and arbitrarily say this agency or that agency, you know, needs to be eliminated. In the case of the Department of Education, that could, because we've actually got 50 states that all have departments of education. And many of them, like in North Dakota, we distribute it down to 175 school districts. We're a local school board where we've got government close to the people and making decisions. And so you could just block grant the money out without all of the federal restrictions and the federal interference, as President Reagan was saying. Just if you really want to put that money out there, then give it to them and let them invest it in ways that work for them. Because what works in a small rural school district, even in North Dakota, maybe doesn't work for the biggest school district we have in Fargo. So it is, but the back to the 10 to 20%, there's 2 million federal employees. I think there's only 4,000 in the Department of Education. But of the 2 million federal employees, something like 200,000 to 400,000 equivalent, not people, but equivalent jobs every day is going towards work that's not meaningful. It's a piece of red tape. It's a law that got passed 30 years ago, and somebody's creating a report that nobody reads. And so we really have to go through and say, how do we take and drive the market forces towards government that we need to, and get those 400,000, like get 20% of the federal employees back in the private sector where they would be, you know, producing tax dollars as opposed to consuming tax dollars.
As you approach the next debate, former President Trump remains far and away the front runner in this race. He's leading decisively, as you know, in every single poll. And no individual who has been leading this early in advance by this much has ever lost the GOP nomination. So what is your plan to get Republican primary voters to choose you over Trump?
Well, I think the first thing, there is there's so many firsts. I mean, every day you turn on the TV, this is the first time this has ever happened, the first time this has ever happened. So I think, again, there's historically so much volatility in the primaries that we're just going to keep, you know, keep driving forward with the things that we know are affecting every American family and driving forward with that plan. And when the voters get to start voting in Iowa and New Hampshire next January, then the voters get to decide. So our plan is to basically get in front of them, have them know who we are. We're the least well-known candidate on the stage, drive name recognition up, drive people understanding that we've got the capability both in the private sector and in the public sector at driving remarkable results, and understand that we're focused on the issues that matter the most. The Cold War with China. How do we win the Cold War with China? How do we prevent World War III? How do we get energy policy in a way that helps get inflation down for every American? So we know that if we keep talking about the issues that matter the most, that that's going to help drive through that. And again, it's not, I've started out with everybody told me you could never build a global software company based in Fargo, North Dakota. You'll never work. You won't get the talent. You won't get the capital. Everybody's bigger. They got more capital. They've got more name recognition. They got all the partnerships with the top companies. And it turned out that none of that was true. And then when people said, well, you can't get elected governor in North Dakota when you're down 60 points in the poll 5 months before the primary, and people saying, don't even start. We just said, no, that's, you know, we're in this because we believe that if we get our message out, that people are going to respond and hear that. So that's what we're doing right here. And we're on the ground in Iowa today. We just got done with a week in New Hampshire, and we're very much looking forward to, watching the real response from real voters to can you climb when they see that they've got an alternative that looks like leadership, and the leadership that America needs, the focused leadership to help drive us through the tumultuous times that are ahead of us.
With respect, Governor, I want to just kick the tires on this, because there are firsts every day. There are firsts in Donald Trump's legal challenges, the former president's indictments. Is that what you're referring to when you say volatility? Because the truth is, there's not a lot of volatility in the polls. Trump still continues to lead despite all of those firsts. So how do you crack into that very strong base of support the president, former president, still has?
Well, I mean, again, Biden's leading in the polls too, but, you know, are you going to go to Las Vegas and go, is he the guy that's actually going to be running in this, you know, for president on the other party next fall? I mean, I think there are so many unknowns. And so it is, you know, forge ahead and keep driving forward and then watch things change. I mean, things can change rapidly. Things can change overnight. We've seen over our history that people that were thought to be the leader, the undisputed leader, and go back in either party, this is the person that's going to win. And then something happens and things collapse and others emerge. And so the only way you find out is actually play the game. I mean, it's like these hypothetical questions that are often asked, it's like saying, look, in the preseason poll, you know, Tampa Bay is going to win the Super Bowl. Well, then I guess we don't even need to play a game. You know, Tom Brady's going to win again when he was playing. I mean, that's why we play. The preseason's over. We're starting the fall season now of politics. Super Bowl is not going to be till next January. And I don't know who's going to win the Super Bowl. And I don't know who's going to win Iowa and New Hampshire. But I certainly know that if you're not in the game and you're not competing, then you don't have a chance to win at all. So we're out there. Voters know that we're going to be there in January. They know that we're going to be on the ballot. They said, we're going to get out there one person at a time. No one's going to outwork us. That's one of the hallmarks that you'll understand, whether it's, you know, as governor, as a candidate, or as president. When I'm your president, you're going to have somebody, you know, that gets up every day and he's working for the American people, not for themselves, not for some other cause. I'm doing it out of a heart of service, because I know that we can put together the team that can lead this country forward during these incredibly challenging times. I know the formula: strong economy, smart energy policy, national security that keeps our adversaries at bay. That's what's going to make us strong. That's what's going to ensure that, you know, your kids and everybody else's kids don't have to worry about World War III, because we're going to prevent it the same way Ronald Reagan prevented, he won the Cold War with strength, you know, peace through strength, but he also won it with having the strongest economy in the world. And we've got an opportunity to do that. China imports 10 million barrels of oil a day, and they have to import food to feed their people every day. And we've had four officials from the Biden administration there this year, and they haven't even talked about energy policy. We've got super tools in our toolbox to win a Cold War, and we're not using them. But as president, I will use them, and we can not only make America better, we can make the world a better place.
You said at the last debate, Governor, that Mike Pence did the right thing on January 6th. Did Donald Trump do the wrong thing?
Courts are going to decide that. My goodness, I can't even keep track of all of it, but they'll decide that. But you know, one of the hallmarks of our democracy is peaceful transfer of power, and I think that you know America and the whole world is holding its breath. But here we are, and yes, he did the right thing, and we have to go forward. But as a Republican Party, if we're talking about 2020, that's the way we lose. You know, the people that love us talking about the past, Biden administration, Biden's candidacy totally depends on us talking about the past and infighting and China. And Russia, everybody that said democracy won't work. Yeah, it's gone for 250 years, but it won't work. It'll collapse under itself. And of course, when we've got our open society and freedom of speech, and you could have 40% of the accounts on some social media could be bots run by foreign countries that are also agitating divisiveness in our country. At some point, we have to say, look, we have to be strong enough to survive with our hanging on to our freedom and liberty and being the open country. But I have great hope and optimism for our country. When we talked earlier tonight, Margaret, about immigration, we're talking about the fact that people are risking their lives to get to our country. The competitors we're trying to beat, Iran, who's trying to get a nuclear weapon and destroy the U.S. and Israel, Russia, China, these countries, they all have walls too, but they have walls to keep people in. You know, we need one to have an orderly entrance into our country. We're still the place where talent and capital wants to flow, but that's not going to always be there unless we figure out, you know, how to get our act together across the economy, energy, and national security. We have to do those three things, or we're not going to just sit back and say forever and forever we're going to be the place. But we have to have a peaceful transfer of power. It's, again, that's the foundation of democracy.
I hear your rationale, and I hear what you're saying. I've noticed that you rarely criticize Donald Trump by name. And I've also noticed that most of your complaints about the direction of our politics, the divisiveness and the insults and the focus on the past over the future, happen to typify Donald Trump, who has promised that if he is elected to a second term, it will be driven by retribution against his enemies. And while you supported Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020 and have said that you would support him again if he is the nominee, even if he's a convicted felon at that point, how do you square that with the importance of character and divisiveness and transcending that in our politics?
Well, if you're referencing the debate question,
if former President Trump is convicted in a court of law, would you still support him as your party's choice?
Everybody on that stage, to get on that stage, had signed something that said, we're going to support the eventual nominee. There was no asterisk. There was no like, if this, if that, whatever. We're supporting the actual nominee. So when they asked the question, and I guess people didn't raise their hand, I guess, did they sign the document or not? I mean, that was the rule to get on the stage. And so I'm not going to go back and parse, you know, that out. But, you know, if I'm running for the president of the United States, trying to win the president's sights, I'm running against all the other candidates, including the former president, because I believe America needs a choice. And I think that people understand where I stand because that's why I'm running. And I'm running because we need character. We need integrity. We need to restore trust and honesty. We need to have people who've spent a lifetime of building trust. I mean, there's a reason why there are high school classmates, college classmates, people from the first startup I was involved with, grad school classmates. At every walk of my life, someone has volunteered and is helping on this campaign. That doesn't happen unless you've built up a massive amount of trust with people through relationships, decade after decade after decade after decade. And we could use some of that in the White House where people would say, yeah, everybody that ever has known this guy trusts him and knows that he is someone that they can count on to do the right thing when they need to. That would, you know, our youngest is going to turn 25 in a couple weeks. He's voted in two presidential elections. I was talking to him and his friends and they said, Dad, it would be really cool if we could vote for someone instead of against someone. Because I think we all know that the elections in 16 and 20 involved a lot of people going into the booth and then saying, nope, I can't do that. I'm gonna do whatever to plug my nose and vote for the other one. America deserves to have an opportunity to vote for someone that they believe in, for someone that they can trust, someone that's got the honesty, the integrity, the vision, the capability, and the proven track record to be able to get it done. Someone that they know that actually cares deeply about the American people, because nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's Theodore Roosevelt said that. He understood that. And that's why we're running.
Governor Doug Burgum, thank you for joining me on Firing Line. We'll be watching.
Thank you.